52 days was all Nehemiah and the Israelites needed to rebuild the wall around Jerusalem. By comparison, it took a full 8 years to complete the Roman Colosseum, 3 years to raise the Eiffel Tower, and the other Great Wall of Antiquity, the Great Wall of China. Brick by brick, it was built over a period of 1,900 years. Regardless of how long they take, projects that require vision are seldom a straightforward sprint to the finish. They have ups and downs, small victories followed by major setbacks. In the case of Nehemiah, his setback came early. At the start of the project, all of the Israelites were on board. They tirelessly labored day and night, a mass of energy and movement, united behind a vision to see their capital city restored to glory. But soon their energy and enthusiasm were replaced by fear as repeated threats of attack sent the people into a panic and ground the work of rebuilding to a halt. At that moment, when the shovel stopped digging and the bricks were abandoned, Nehemiah had a simple choice to make: quit or follow through. It is the same dilemma that faces every visionary, great or small, no matter what the task. Great accomplishments throughout our history have been won after pushing through seemingly insurmountable challenges. During World War II, when faced with certain defeat, for Winston Churchill, the answer was clear: never give up, never give up, never give up. At that moment, when all seemed lost, Nehemiah would not surrender his vision and chose to endure. He knew if the Israelites overcame their fears, they could accomplish what God had called them to do. So he rallied the people, posted armed guards, fortified the wall against attack, and inspired the rebuilding effort to continue. Until at last, after 40 years of lying in ruin and 2 months of rebuilding, the wall was finally complete, and the very last brick, the final piece, and the fulfillment of the vision was laid into place.
One of the best feelings in life is probably when you finish a big project. Maybe you're into home repair and you've been working on a project in your own home for months, or maybe it's been years. And man, when you get that thing finished, it is a great feeling. Maybe you've been working on something at work, something around here, but when you finish, it's time to celebrate. In fact, great leaders like Nehemiah knew that when there was some completion of a vision, it was time to celebrate. And so we've been tracking the rebuild process that Nehemiah experienced when he went to his hometown of Jerusalem and rebuilt the wall. And after 52 days and a successful rebuild, the people all gathered for a celebration. And in the midst of that celebration, a priest got up and began to read the Bible to the people, began to read what was already written of the Bible at that point. And as he read through all of the different promises that God made to the nation of Israel, to Nehemiah's people, the people just celebrated. Because God told them, hey, this city, Jerusalem, this is your city. I've given it to you, and I'm going to continue to restore it if you lose it. And all of these things, and the people just began to read that, and they began to celebrate. But there was something else that they read as well, and they began to look at all of the things that God had asked them to do. And they thought about all the times they had failed God. And so in the midst of this great celebration of all these people, this thing starts to turn south, because the people begin to cry when they think about all of the times they failed God. And Nehemiah, sensing the situation like a great leader does, stepped in at that point, and he said some words that really turned the tide and turned the people once again back to celebration. In Nehemiah chapter 8, verse 10, Nehemiah said this. He said, go and enjoy choice food and sweet drinks, and send some to those who have nothing prepared. This day is sacred to our Lord. Do not grieve, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. See, what Nehemiah said in that moment to the people was, he said, this celebration isn't about us remembering all the times that we failed God. We know that we've done some things that have been inconsistent with the promises we made to God, but in this moment, we're focusing on the fact that God has continued to be faithful to us. We're focusing on what God has done, that in 52 days, despite great opposition, we've been able to rebuild this wall. And so Nehemiah says to them, hey, you need to know that God has joy when he thinks about us. And even when we fail, God continues to be faithful to us because of his joy. And he says, hey, you can be strengthened by that. The joy of the Lord can be your strength. What he's saying to us today is that when you think about your vision, it's easy to focus on the failures. But instead of focusing on the failures, set your eyes and your mind on the faithfulness of God. And remember that because God delights in us, even as we make failures, as long as we're pursuing the vision, we can be strengthened by that. So I want to invite you all to stand this morning, because we're going to sing a song that is written straight from the words of Nehemiah. And it just says, hey, we agree with that. We know that when we're pursuing vision, even when we fail, we can be strengthened with joy because God remains faithful. Visionaries, visionary people. When I see that video, I'm just struck by how much of a visionary you need to be. And one of the themes that I see throughout all of those stories is that the difference between just having a vision and completing it always boils down to how you deal with the setbacks along the way. All of those folks talked about their setbacks. The guy in the park who was able to actually get married in that park, a little bit of backstory there is it actually took 7 years before he could take the first step, before he could lay the first brick in rebuilding that park, because he had to wait for a permit, and he was kind of going back and forth for 7 years. And then, as he said in the video, it was another 2 years before the park was completed. 9 years of his life. And so when you hear that story, you know, the difference between the beginning and the ending always boils into these setbacks and how you handle them. And so what we want to talk about today as we continue to explore the story of Nehemiah is, how do you handle setbacks as you're pursuing your vision? So that's where we're going today. Let's pray. God, I pray that you would teach us in this time. And for everyone in here, God, and I do believe that you have given vision to all of us. It could be a vision for our family. It could be a vision for a new business idea. It could be a vision for something that we want to do that will literally change the world. And I just pray that today, as we continue to learn, what does it mean to rebuild and how do you go after the vision that you've given to all of us, that you would just teach us in that time through your wisdom and through the Bible. In Jesus' name, amen. Does anybody have a friend who you would say is a visionary, kind of like those folks on the video? You know, I have been kind of lucky to have several friends throughout my life that I would say are just visionaries. People who have an ability to see past reality. And sometimes when you talk to them, it's almost like they're on another planet, because they can see things that you just can't even begin to fathom. And I was kind of fortunate to have one of those friends introduced into my life when I was in high school. His name is Omar. I call him O. And O is just one of these guys that is a clear visionary. You know, I remember connecting with O very early in my high school experience. And I think it was like sophomore year. Omar just had this vision. He said, hey, listen, I'm going to be the starting running back for this varsity football team at Central. So, you know, he just called that thing out. And, you know, you can say, all right, well, that's great. But here's what you need to know. Omar was probably about 2 feet shorter than the competition for this role. 2 feet shorter, wasn't the biggest guy, but Omar had heart and he had vision, and I watched him pursue that vision. He became the starting running back, actually just broke records, just did an amazing job in that role, and that was kind of a microcosm of how Omar lived his life. You know, I remember another time where he was addressing our entire class. We were probably sophomores or juniors, and he was addressing our entire class about how to find your purpose in life and how to pursue a vision for your life. And I remember now, as I reflect on it, that he was so far ahead of everybody else in the room, because, you know, everybody else in the room was like me. My vision all focused on the weekend. My vision was about, how can I get this girl over here to go out with me? That was my vision. And Omar was just so far beyond that. And so, as you can imagine, when you have a friend like that, they take you to places that you wouldn't go yourself. And so when I was in college, Omar, who had told us in high school, you know, this is what I want to do for a living. I want to go around and encourage groups, encourage students, people, adults, to find their vision in life. And I want to be a speaker and a communicator and do that. When he was in high school, he said that. When we were in college, Omar actually took some steps toward that and invited myself and another guy in, and we started a business where we would go to students and organizations, and we would go to colleges, and we would actually talk to people about purpose and vision. And Omar just kind of was living this thing out. You know, for me and Brian, the other two guys in the business, for us, it was kind of one of those things where we said, all right, after college and after we graduate, we're going to leave this and get real jobs, and maybe we'll come back to it at some point. But Omar was just so focused on this vision that even after Brian and I peeled away, he kind of picked up the pieces of that. And today he and his wife actually do that for a living. He travels around the country, has been to Miami University right here in Ohio, to do exactly what he set out to do in high school. And the other thing is, when you have a visionary friend like that, you get a lot of benefits and gifts. And Omar has given me a lot of wisdom and insight and experiences that I wouldn't have otherwise had in my life very early on. But by far, the best gift he ever gave me was this right here. This is the first journal that I ever actually received and started to use to kind of capture my life. And Omar was one of those folks who was a student of greatness. And one of the things he said is, when you look at the lives of great people, they have examined their lives throughout. They, matter of fact, journaling is one of the ways and tools they use to handle the setbacks that come. They examine their life. And so he would always get on me, "Chuck, you need to journal. You need to journal. You need to be journaling about your life." And when I left in October of 2000 and moved to Cincinnati, this is what Omar gave me as a gift. And I just want to read to you what he wrote on the first page of this journal. He said, "Chuck, the quality of this journal accentuates the quality of life that you are expected to live. I pray that you enrich others with the seed that God has deposited in you. Now, the journal is present because every great man records the path of his destiny. Please do so. Others will need to know the pain, the heart, the mind, and the glory of the servant leader." And Omar gave this to me, and there's no way he could have known, and if I would have known, I wouldn't have left, that the next 2 years, because of this move, were going to be some of the times in my life where I experienced some of the greatest setbacks I've ever experienced in my life. And that's just true for everyone who's pursuing a vision. We see it in the book of Nehemiah. You know, you would think that after the celebration and after that final brick went in the wall, that from that point on, the story of Nehemiah just continues on this high note and ends on a really strong, you know, perfect ending. But actually, as we're going to see today, at the end of the story of Nehemiah, it actually ends in failure. It ends with these major setbacks that Nehemiah has to confront. And as I look at how he confronts those setbacks, and as we look at that together, we can find out how to confront the setbacks that we'll experience on the path to our vision. So I want to take you first to Nehemiah chapter 10. In the 10th chapter of this book, Nehemiah and the people have just finished the celebration. And like I said, they noticed that there were all these promises that they had made to God. And so the people see the success of the wall and say, "Hey, we're going to go back to making those commitments to God." And so this is what it says in Nehemiah 10. It says, "We promise not to give our daughters in marriage to the peoples around us or take their daughters for our sons." And so they're saying something that God had asked them to do was, "Hey, listen, when you marry outside of the community, you get influenced by other religions. And so I want you to kind of keep this within yourselves because I want you to be focused on me." And so he asked them not to marry outside of that. And they said, "Yes, we're going to keep that promise." They also said, "When the neighboring peoples bring merchandise or grain to sell on the Sabbath, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath or any holy day." This was in response to one of the other things that God had asked them to commit to, which was basically take one day out of seven and set it aside as a day where you don't do any work. Because even though it's important to work, I want you to also know that you need to rely on me. And so the people had gotten away from that. They said, "We're going back to that. We're not going to do anything on the Sabbath." And then finally, they said, "We will not neglect the house of our God." The central experience for the city of Jerusalem was the temple, the house of God. And it had gone into disrepair. The people had an opportunity to rebuild that. And they said, "We are not going to neglect the house of God again." And so the people make these promises to God. And actually, after this, Nehemiah leaves the scene. We talked the first week that Nehemiah was a cupbearer to the king of Persia. And that king had actually subdued the nation of Israel, and they were subservient to him, but he had certain people who he trusted who worked in his palace, and Nehemiah was one of those people. And so Nehemiah had a day job, but he had actually left that job because he was so burdened for his city that he went to Jerusalem and he rebuilt the wall. After his project was complete, it was time for him to go back to his day job. And so 10 to 12 years have passed from verse 10, from chapter 10, which we just read. And Nehemiah is, you know, interacting with the king again. And he says, "I'd like to go back. I want to follow through and I want to reengage with those relationships and see how that vision of the rebuilt wall and our rebuilt spiritual foundations is going." So Nehemiah now is reengaging in this chapter we're going to explore, chapter 13. And like I said, he comes back to these major setbacks. Let's take a look at what he comes back to. Nehemiah says, "Sometime later, I asked permission and came back to Jerusalem. Here I learned about the evil thing Eliashib, who was one of the priests, had done in providing Tobiah a room in the courts of the house of God." And what you need to know is Tobiah was one of the major enemies of the rebuilding effort of the wall. He was one of the people that absolutely did not want the wall rebuilt. But in 10 to 12 years' time, the people had come to this place of compromise where they actually gave their enemy a room in God's house. They had gotten that far away from that promise of not neglecting God's house. So broken promise there. Nehemiah goes on to report this. "In those days, I saw men in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in grain and loading it on donkeys. They're two for two. Broken promise. They said they would not work on the Sabbath. And when he comes, what does he find? People working on the Sabbath. And then the final thing he says is this. Moreover, in those days, I saw men of Judah who had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. These people are batting 1,000. And it's not a good 1,000. They have broken all three of the promises they made to God. And so Nehemiah comes back into this situation in Jerusalem to major, major setbacks. Honestly, he came back to an Israel that has succeeded physically, but failed spiritually. And so the question that we want to wrestle with today is, what do you do when in pursuit of your vision, you face those kind of setbacks? Maybe like me, you know what it feels like to succeed physically, but fail spiritually. And what do? You see, when it comes to handling setbacks, this isn't a question of if you handle setbacks or if you embrace setbacks, how will you deal with them? It isn't a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Setbacks are coming. If you're pursuing a vision, setbacks are coming. It reminds me of something my mom used to say to me when I was a kid. You know, when you're young, you can have kind of the arrogance of youth. And you can think that certain experiences in life will just never come your way, or if they do, you never would struggle with it the same way someone else did. And my mom had a great way of kind of putting me in my place on that. She said, baby, just keep on living. Just keep on living. If you keep on living long enough, you will face setbacks in pursuit of your vision. Just keep on living. So Nehemiah faces these setbacks. We embrace these setbacks as well. And like I said, when I got this journal from Omar, he couldn't have known that in the next 2 years of my life, in the words that are captured in this journal, I would face some very significant setbacks in my life. You know, when I moved to Cincinnati, probably within that first year, I had an economic challenge kind of come my way that really was a result of some poor decisions that I had made. When I left school, one of the things that I did is I bought a duplex. And that was a big deal for me, and it was kind of a sign that I had made it. And what I did was I lived on the top floor, and my mom and dad lived on the bottom floor, because it was a way for me to give back to them and kind of say, hey, I've done good. I'm coming back home, and I've done good. And so I had this home, and I had this mortgage, and my brother and I partnered on that. And it was a great opportunity for our family to do something financially to kind of advance ourselves and help ourselves. But when I moved to Cincinnati, I knew that my economic situation was changing. I mean, obviously, I had to have a place to live here, and how was I going to be able to support a house back in Philadelphia and kind of take care of my living expenses here? But because of pride, because of fear and not wanting to confront maybe some situations, family situations, I just kind of tried to make it work. And over time, I wound up foreclosing on that home, wound up losing it. Major, major setback. You can imagine the implications for my credit. At the time, being in my 20s and having a foreclosure on your credit doesn't really help things a whole lot. And obviously there was some family tension as a result of what happens now. What was going to happen to my parents? If I don't own this home anymore, are they going to be evicted when somebody else buys? What now? Maybe I've put them in a situation where they're not stable. So I was wrestling through that. It was a major, major setback for me. I've also talked before about how I almost tanked my marriage in those 2 years before it even began. In the engagement process, it came out that I had a hidden addiction to pornography that I had been trying to keep from my fiance and trying to manage on my own. And that thing came out, and it threatened to tank my marriage before it began. Major setbacks. I know what it feels like to succeed physically, but fail spiritually. Because if you saw me then, you would think I had it all together. I had a great job. I had a great car. On the surface, I was doing the right things, saying the right things. But inside, spiritually, as I think about how I was living my life, I was failing. I was failing. And so the question is, how do you handle that? What do you do when you're in that situation? Well, as I look at the story of how Nehemiah responds to these setbacks, we can learn some disciplines that help us handle setbacks. You see, because I want to call them disciplines because these are basic core things that we all can do, but they're also some of the hardest things to do. But if we do them, setbacks, when we experience them, don't have to stop us from our vision. They actually can strengthen us to complete the vision that God has for us. So we're going to explore that. And as we look at the first one, the first thing I see in how Nehemiah responds is you have to learn from your setbacks. You have to learn from your setbacks. You know, one of the things that used to frustrate me when I worked in corporate was what I like to call swoop-in managers. Maybe you work for one. If they're next to you now, you probably don't want to say that too loud. But here's what a swoop-in manager does. They swoop in And in a matter of what seems like minutes, they list all the problems they see on your team, in your workspace, in the project that you're working on. But then they swoop out. They swoop out. They don't have to stay for the implementation. They don't have to help you get resources to solve some of those problems. They're swoop-in managers who swoop in, poop all over what you have, and then they swoop out. That's what they do. Swoop-in managers. And so if you ever experienced that, you know how frustrating that is. Well, you know, Nehemiah could have been a swoop-in leader because his vision was to rebuild the wall. 10 years ago, he had done that. He had swooped in, and in a matter of 52 days, he rebuilt the wall. And he was back in what was a pretty good job as a servant to the king. And so he could have just said, hey, I'm done. You know what? I've tried. I've done all I can. And man, they just got to figure out stuff on their own. But what Nehemiah did is he was willing to go back and learn. He was willing to once again confront the reality of what was going on in his city. He confronted the setbacks that he had. He was willing to learn. And this reminds me of a book that was really formative to me as I began to process through some of the experiences and setbacks that I had in my life. The book is called Ordering Your Private World, and it's by Gordon MacDonald. I've talked about this book before, and I'm sure I'll talk about it again. Just a really formative book for me. And it tells the story of Gordon MacDonald, who was a pastor at the time. And it starts with what he calls the day he hit the wall. The day he hit the wall. And he was a pastor. He was kind of doing his weekly thing, getting ready for the next week, when all of a sudden he just became emotionally overwhelmed. And it was almost like all of his life just imploded on him at that point of preparation, where he realized, here I am trying to prepare this great talk and try to be this great person on the stage this Sunday, but I'm not necessarily doing all I need to do to be a great father or a great husband. And he began to just have to wrestle with the contradictions in his life. And what he realized at that point was his skills and the things that had brought him to a place of success were not going to be enough to take him to the next phase of his vision. You know, for me, I can say that for me, I saw in my life when these setbacks were happening, when I stopped and thought about what was going on, what had happened was my skills were being close to being, they were outpacing my character. And so I had great skills. I did well in school, and I was a great communicator, and I was a great leader and all that stuff. I had all this stuff on the resume, but my character hadn't grown up to match my skill set. And if you're in here and you're in your mid to late 20s or your early 30s, I think you know what it feels like to hit the wall. And if you haven't, just keep on living. It's coming. It's coming, maybe for some of you who have been there before. I think it's just something that happens at that point in your life where you just come to this place where your skills are not going to be enough for the vision that you have. And so you have to start dealing with some inner issues and some things that may very well just keep you stuck if you never move past it. You know, for some of us, this series may be very frustrating. And if it's frustrating, it might be because you feel stuck. You know that you have an emotional just call to some vision, but it seems like you can't move past it. And I just want to say, maybe one of the reasons is because you've not stopped to learn. You know, a guy came in and talked to staff a couple weeks ago, and he was just talking about how this learning process happens. And I love how he put this. He says, you need to be willing to sit at the feet of your own pain. You need to be willing to sit at the feet of your own pain. And for me, that learning process was painful. You know, when I looked at those financial choices that I made, I had to recognize that the choices were behaviors. Those were symptoms, but those behaviors were based on some beliefs. And they were based on some things that I valued about money that I shouldn't have been valuing. And when I really sat at the feet of my own pain, I began to uncover that. I began to uncover those things. You know, that addiction and those choices I was making, that was just my chosen medication to not deal with the pain of life. We all have a different kind, but for me, it was that. And so it wasn't all about the behaviors. Yes, the behaviors were wrong, but it wasn't all about the behaviors. It was about getting underneath the behaviors and understanding why it was that I was susceptible to that. What was really going on the inside? You have to be willing to learn. Nehemiah stepped into reality, wasn't afraid to confront it. He sat at the feet of that pain and he learned from those setbacks. The second discipline I see is probably one of the reasons that I love this book of Nehemiah in the Bible. It's one of the books I read a lot because it's so practical. Because not only did Nehemiah learn, the second thing is you have to act. You have to act. If you're going to deal with setbacks in your life, you need to do some things. You have to act. So let's look at the story again. And particularly, let's go to the whole, you know, letting the enemy in the house of God, what happened with Tobiah. And let's see how Nehemiah responds to that. Later on, it picks up in verse 8, And it says this, Nehemiah says, I was greatly displeased and threw all Tobiah's household goods out of the room. I gave orders to purify the rooms, and then I put back into them the equipment of the house of God with the grain offerings and the incense. Nehemiah steps into the situation. He learns about the setbacks, and then he acts. Nehemiah makes hard calls, and he cleans house, physically cleans house. Who wants a clean house? Am I the only person that watches that? Clean house, Niecy Nash, any fans? For those of you who aren't the Renaissance man that I am and don't know what that show is about, let me explain to you what the show is about. This is a show that comes on the Style Network. And what happens in an hour of this show is this team comes to a person's home or family's home that has a major issue with clutter. Not like the clutter at your house. I'm talking about major, major clutter. Clutter that looks like this right here. This is somebody's living room, folks. This is somebody's living room on the show. And what they do is they step into this situation and they work with the family and they make these crazy, unbelievable, like how could anybody suggest it, recommendations to these people. Like they tell them stuff like, why don't you throw away stuff you don't use anymore? Just unbelievable recommendation. Why would you, you know, they say stuff like, hey, how about let's have a yard sale and sell some of the stuff you don't use anymore. Just, you know, breakthrough stuff. And so, as you can imagine, they struggle through this with these folks. But what they do after that is when they finally get them to get rid of stuff and sell stuff, they take the money from the yard sale and they use it to rehab the room. And so they take the room from this to that. That's the same room. That's the same room. And so in the course of an hour, you get to see these people go through this journey of cleaning house. And, you know, the thing that strikes me about this, I watched this show. I've never heard this in the interaction between the host and the family. I've never heard the family say, man, you know what, Niecy? I've learned something today. I've learned that my house is cluttered. I mean, if I just knew that my house was cluttered, maybe I would have done something about it. No, it's not an issue of what these people know. You don't live in a room like that and not know that it's cluttered. It's not an issue of what they know. It's an issue of what they do. Let's take a look at that cluttered room again. You know, I know for some of us, I do this when I watch this show. I'm like, man, I would never let a room in my house get that bad. This is really extreme, Chuck. Like, come on. I mean, clearly there's something beneath this going on with these folks. You know, and I agree with you. I think there are very few of us that will let our room in a house get like that. Can I just be real with you, though? For some of us, our dating relationships look like that. For some of us, our marriages look like that. For some of us, how we relate to our kids look just like that. We would never let a room in our house get that cluttered. But if we take a look at what's beneath the surface in our lives, and if we look at some of the setbacks and the walls we keep hitting, we have to deal with the reality that sometimes it's not an issue of what we know. You know that it's cluttered. You know that something's broken in that relationship. But it's an issue of what we're not doing. You need to act. If you're going to move through setbacks in your life, there comes a time where you need to act. I was talking with a friend of mine about this, and he said it boils down to the basics of just doing what you know to do. Just doing what you know to do. You know, the next series after we wrap up this week is going to be a series called Core Strength. And we're going to be talking about the things that you do if you want to be a person who's engaging in understanding more of who Jesus is. And you know what? There might be some things in this next series that you didn't know before. It might be some concepts that may be new to you. But I'd be willing to say that for many of us, it's not going to be an issue of what we learn that's new. It's going to be an issue of, man, here's a different way to do something to engage with God. So you don't want to miss that series. That's where we're going next. But I know when I look at the setbacks in my life, I got to the point where I had to recognize it wasn't about what I know. It's about what I was doing. See, I knew it was wrong to foreclose on a home. I actually had a 4-year degree in finance and investment management. I knew. I knew it was wrong. It wasn't an issue of what I knew. It was an issue of what I was doing. You know, I knew that it was wrong to try to start a marriage with a hidden addiction. I mean, let's just take morality out of it. You know, maybe you're in a different place on whether you believe the Bible is true. And that's cool. That's what we want to be, is a place where we can ask some honest questions. But can we all agree that that's probably not the best foot forward in a marriage? I knew that. It wasn't an issue of what I knew. It was an issue of what I was doing. So I had to do some different things. When it came to finances, I was just thinking about this. I hadn't mentioned it in the other services. I don't know why I didn't remember it. One of the things I did is I actually had to move in with a friend from work. And I did some other financial things to significantly change my financial situation. I had to do some things that I knew to do. And when it came to that addiction, I had to get help. I had to get into accountable relationships with other guys. I had to be willing to step into recovery and continue to do that today because I need to be in a place where I can be healthy and whole or else I can go right back to the place where I came from. It wasn't an issue of what I knew. It was an issue of what I was doing. We need to do what we know to do. So Nehemiah deals with these setbacks and he learns. He's willing to sit at the feet of his own pain. He also acts. He does what he knows to do. But there's a third thing that honestly, like I said, I read this book of Nehemiah. I read it regularly. I've never noticed this before. There's a phrase that gets repeated over and over again in this chapter. And what would happen is Nehemiah would embrace a situation. He'd learn and he'd find out something was wrong. So he'd learn that Tobiah was in the temple. And then he'd act and he'd throw him out of the temple. And then he would say, "Remember me, God, for this." And later on, he learned that the people were, in fact, selling things on the Sabbath. And he acted and took change and made change happen so that they stopped doing that. And then on the side of that, he would say, "And remember me for this, God." And I got to the point where I'm like, is this guy just that cocky and arrogant that as he's working through these setbacks, he's got to stop and remind God, "Hey, don't forget who was on the right side of the issue here. Hey, don't forget who was the guy making the great moral decisions. Hey, God, it was me." And so I begin to kind of dig a little bit deeper about, well, what does he mean when he says, "Remember me"? He keeps repeating this phrase. And what I found is that's actually the third discipline. After you learn and after you act, the third thing is you need to remember. We all know that the Bible was not written in the English language originally, that it's in Hebrew, in particular this part of the Bible was written in Hebrew. And so sometimes when you go back to the original language, you learn some more color, you get more perspective around what a word might mean in the context in which it was written. You can go online and do that. There are tools to do that very easily. And I began to do some research on this word remember. And what I found out was this word is actually the word zakar. It's where we get the name Zachary from. So if you're hearing your name is Zach or Zachary, you know that your name means God recalls or God remembers. And this kind of remembering is not just God saying, "Oh yeah, I know who that person is. Oh yeah, I remember who that person is." But this word was always connected to action. Not only did God remember, but then God actually acted favorably for or on someone's behalf. And Nehemiah hits this in chapter 13, 22. One of the things he says is, "Remember me for this also, O my God, and show mercy to me according to your great love." When he was saying, "God, Zakar, God, remember me," what he was saying was, "God, as I interact with these setbacks, there's stuff I need to learn and there's stuff I need to do, but I also need you to remember. I need you to act favorably and do things for me and the people that we cannot do for ourselves. God, I need you to Zakar." And so I began to look and find other places where this is used. And I found that it was used in the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis. And particularly, it says that God zakared a man named Noah. And the story is that God had looked at humankind at that point in time in Noah's life, and only Noah and his family were following after him. They were the only people who were really connecting with God. And God said, "Listen, I'm going to send a flood, and I'm going to destroy the people because they are not following after me. But when I look at you and your family, Noah, I see that you are following me. So I'm going to ask you to build this ark, and I'm going to have your family be in this ark, and it's going to be a way for me to preserve you and your family in the midst of what I'm about to do." And later on in the story, it says that God zakared Noah, and the floodwaters receded, and Noah and his family walked out on dry land. And God, through Noah and his family, repopulated the earth and perpetuated his promise with people. And then it shows up again in the second book of the Bible, the book of Exodus, where God zakared the nation of Israel. And he had an interaction by a bush with a shepherd named Moses. And in that moment, God chose Moses and gave Moses the vision to be about going to Egypt, where the Israelites were in slavery at the time, and free them from their slavery, to go and interact with Pharaoh and to literally help the people leave slavery. So God zakared Israel. He called Moses and he brought his people out of slavery. And so I just begin to think about, man, this word is really an opportunity for me to think about the setbacks in my own life and recognize that as I flip through the pages of this journal, I have to just come to grips with the fact that there's some stuff that I wrote about in here that clearly I couldn't have done for myself. That God acted favorably for me. Yes, there were things I had to learn. And yes, there were things I needed to do differently. But there was also clear Zakar moments as I look at how I dealt with the setbacks in my life. I look at my life and I know that when I think about what happened with my finances over those 2 years and beyond, things happened for me that I couldn't have planned for. You know, things coming right on time that I couldn't have prepared for. And I look at that and I know that was God acting favorably for me. That was something I couldn't do for myself. You know, my wife and I celebrated 6 years of marriage. And I'm happy to report we're also the proud parents of a new baby boy. Thank you. I know many of you heard me talk about setbacks that we experienced in the midst of the pregnancy. And baby and mom are happy and healthy. And friends, when I look at my family, when I go home to my family today, it's a reminder that God has acted favorably for me. Because we weren't married when I came out to my wife about my addiction. She could have walked away. She didn't have anything holding her to the relationship other than her willingness to forgive me and to give me another chance. And you know what? I couldn't have done that for myself. That was God acting favorably on my behalf. And you know, over the last couple of weeks, if you've been here, we've talked and joked about Brian Tome and the accident on the Harley with the deer. You know, we had some great laughs about that. And you know what? For me, part of the humor in that and part of the joy, it really is a joyful thing, is I recognize that Brian, God Zakar'd Brian on that road. You see, there's nothing that said that statistically, he could have died. Statistically, he could have had brain damage. Statistically, you can't tell me those things weren't in the realm of reality. So when I look at that situation, it's a clear example that God acted favorably for Brian. And you know what? That makes me joyful because Brian is not just a leader on a hierarchical chart to me. He's my friend. And I'm excited when I think about how God remembered and acted favorably for Brian. And you know, this thing of God acting favorably is mysterious. And I just want to say, I don't know why God didn't Zakar my uncle when he died last year of cirrhosis. I don't know why God didn't Zakar other people in my life who I've lost. I don't know why God didn't Zakar marriages that have broken apart. I don't know why. It's mysterious. But I just have to look at my life. I have to look at the setbacks I experienced and realize there are things that happened for me I couldn't do for myself. And in those moments, I'm reminded and I remember that God has acted favorably for me. And one of the things that I do, and I usually do this around the end of the year, beginning of the next year, is I read through, particularly this journal. And when I look through these pages, I remember. I remember times in my life where God did things for me I couldn't do for myself. As a car. And you know, one of the other ways that I do that is through music. I don't know if you've ever had this experience. I think we all have. Just you hear a song and it kind of just says what you wish you could put to words for a particular person or a particular situation. Anybody ever had that experience? Well, there's a song that I want you to just listen to. I just want you to sit in this moment and hear these words because this song says what I wish I could put to words and what I'm talking about with this whole idea of what it means for God to remember us. And as you listen to it, I just want to ask you to think about the times in your life. Maybe a specific time where something happened for you that was just a little bit more than being in the right place at the right time. It was a little bit more than just, you know, dumb luck. Something that could have taken you out. Maybe you're sitting next to a person that could have easily walked out on you, but your marriage is restored. Maybe you're a person who's in a dating relationship and you never thought you'd find someone that you could connect with and now you have it. I don't know what it is for you. Maybe your kids have gotten through a health challenge and on the other side of that, you just know this was more than luck. I want you to think about a time in your life when that has happened for you as you listen to the words of this song. I want to say something to the person who feels stuck. If that's you today, I just want you to hear a few words. You made it. Let me say that again. You made it. You made it. You made it. I know right now you don't know how you're going to get past this setback. But maybe if you just stop and look at where you've been, it's undeniable that sometimes it was more than just dumb luck. Sometimes stuff happens and it's not coincidence. You made it because there's a God who acts favorably for you. There's a God who is pursuing you. with furious love. And he's been there. He's been there for you in the time when nobody else was. He's been there for you in the time when you thought you were all by yourself. And friends, today you are here because you made it. You made it. How do you handle setbacks? How do you handle them when they come? It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Yes, there's some things you need to learn and there's some things that you need to do. You need to act. But I want you to know that there is also a time to remember that there is a God who wants to have relationship with you. And he wants to act favorably on your behalf. And if that's you today and you feel stuck, I want you to know you can continue to move. You can continue to rebuild because God is acting favorably for you. You made it. God, I just pray that in this moment you would seal this in our spirit. You would seal it in the part of us that goes beyond reason. You would seal it in the part of us that we can't explain away. And that in our deep spirit, we would just know that, yes, there are some things that God has done for me that I just couldn't have done for myself. And maybe, God, there are people in here who don't even know if they believe that you're real. I just pray that they would sit in the memory of that and that that would be part of what brings them to an understanding that, man, there might be something to this God thing. God, for all of us, for all of the visions in this place, for all of the purpose in this place, I just pray, God, that we would remember that you are waiting to act favorably for us. God, seal it in us today. I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. You guys have a great Labor Day.